When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
They have the most terrifying powers ever created. And they are winning.
Boils and ghouls, lock your doors and strap yourselves in. From Los Angeles, California, Bloody Disgusting presents the Boo Crew Podcast. Horror news, commentary, reviews, interviews, and more. With your hosts, Lauren and Trevor Shand and Leone D'Antonio.
Hey, happy Friday. It's your Boo Crew. My name is Trevor, and on behalf of myself, Lauren and Leo, welcome to episode 401, a surprise episode, because with a movie this good, we got to break some rules. It is the absolutely brilliant No One Will Save You. It's now available on Hulu. It is a spectacular and unique alien invasion experience crafted by creative genius Brian Duffield. We love this guy. We're huge fans. Listen to us gush as Brian joins us to talk all about his adventures as a screenwriter that eventually led to the smash hits The Babysitter, Underwater, Spontaneous. Get inspired by a fascinating look at the process of screenwriting before launching into his new outer space nightmare. Hear about a creature collab with the legendary ADI team from Aliens, Predator, and Annabelle, designing unsettling sonics that are breathtakingly chilling. The thrill of mystique and more. It is an out of this world episode 401 with Brian Duffield, and No One Will Save You. Now slaying.
Go ahead, scream. That's all we need.
Another victim crawls onto the gurney for a Boo Crew autopsy.
Joining Bloody Disgusting's Boo Crew in the Speakeasy Studio is an absolutely astonishing filmmaker whose wild creativity is endlessly inspiring. A professional screenwriter who's conceived a slew of the most electric and fun movies ever made. Each one as refreshing as the next, and Hollywood feels the same way, as much of his work has found its way to the revered blacklist. 2017's The Babysitter, the thrilling award-winning creature feature Underwater, and the Oscar-nominated Love and Monsters, just to name a few. In 2020, he made his directorial feature-length debut with another award winner, the wonderfully original Spontaneous, that is a must-see, as well as plenty more exciting projects and surprises on the way. Everything he does is infused with pure imagination, giving the audience the ultimate exhilaration. Ideas collide and careen off each other fearlessly like a fever dream. He is one of the few that truly crafts out-of-the-box stories in the most unique way, and his latest is just that. A young woman named Bryn wakes up to find her home invaded by non-human biologics. We'll just say that. It is the breathtaking No One Will Save You. It's on Hulu right now. We are honored to welcome the person behind it all, the inimitable Brian Duffield.
Yeah!
That was so flirty.
Wow. We can make out later if you want.
Amazing.
Well, congrats on the new film. Thank you so much for being here. We're huge fans. This is a big deal for us.
Oh, I'm ecstatic. Love talking to fans.
That's good. Hopefully we're not psychotic ones. Well, I think from what you saw, maybe we are psychotic ones. But we're going to start at the beginning of your relationship with the horror genre. And I guess, what were your gateway experiences film-wise growing up?
Not a lot. I grew up, my family was extremely conservative, and they still are. And so horror, there wasn't a ton of that. The gateway horror that I was allowed to watch, I mean, probably Raiders.
Sure, yeah.
You know, that one snuck in back when conservatives hated Nazis.
All the face melting and whatnot.
But yeah, like that was like, you know, I remember watching that and being like, that was so much more graphic than, you know, anything else I was allowed to see at the time. I mean, that, I remember Star Trek VI.
Yeah.
With the floating blood. Really being into that. And then Jurassic Park was the other really big one that I know isn't quite regarded as a horror movie, but it is.
Yeah.
But I remember it was, I was exhilarated by the horror in Jurassic Park. I wasn't scared. I remember my dad when he took me to see, like, covered my eyes during a couple parts, but I was just like, you know, peeking through the fingers. But then I was always so into it. And then, for a while there was, I had less opportunity to watch anything. And I, so I got really into books. And so there's the Christian Stephen King, who's named Frank Peretti, wrote a bunch of kind of Christian appropriate Stephen King type things.
Interesting.
Wow.
And so I got really into him. And he had like a YA series. I remember scaring the shit out of me. I can't remember what it was called now. It was like an Indiana Jones style dad and then his kids. And I think the first book of that series was they are like in like a dig in Iraq and realize they found a door to hell.
What?
And like as a kid, it's been like all that, you know, obsessed with that was in the Left Behind book days too, where everyone was like, you know, if you're not saved, you're going to get left behind. And that was very terrifying to me as well. But it kind of worked opposite, where the Frank Peretti is the Christian Stephen King, therefore made me interested in Stephen King.
Sure.
Instead of it being like the alternate, I was like, well, I want to get to the source of this. And then there's a lot of sneaking in books and reading at school libraries and stuff like that.
Yeah. So what made it Christian? Was it just more morality lessons in each of the stories?
Yeah.
Kind of thing?
And I haven't read them for like 20 plus years at this point now, but it would always like they were like the characters would discuss Christianity, like part of it, I believe, like the ending with the doorway to hell, you know, it's getting opened and then the characters are talking about Christianity and Christ and stuff. But like not honestly not dissimilar to what's the found footage, not is it The Last Exorcist?
Last Exorcism.
Yeah,
with the priest who doesn't believe, and then by the end he believes.
Yeah.
It was kind of it was Christian in that way.
Sure.
I guess without the lack of belief section.
Yeah. So, that actually makes it more scary to me because
the Christianity.
Yeah,
part.
Yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
That's why The Exorcist works.
Yeah.
I think are a huge part of why you're not bored with the priests.
1,000%. Yeah. What do you think that these things did that you saw early on? How did they imprint on your creative vocabulary, per se?
I think, well, again, this is probably like the backwards way into it. But, you know, the conservative culture in the 90s, it wasn't quite like Satanic Panic. But there's a lot of, you know, Harry Potter was such a problematic thing for Christianity. Like, I remember, like, I shouldn't even just say my parents, like, I think Christian culture at large was very alarmed that there was, like, a pro-witch thing out there, as if, like, everyone was gonna, like, you know, graduate and become witches. But I think there's also, like, the spin of that was they, you know, talking about, like, the deeper meaning in these things, you know, like the, if you play the Beatles backwards, you hear the satanic messages kind of thing. So I think that inadvertently primed me to get into the deeper meaning of things and then not finding Satanism, but then finding, you know, how they used genre and horror to talk about, you know, a ton of issues, you know, not just, and there are just great pure slashers and stuff like that, but a lot of classic horror, which is the only things I could really find at like a video store, you know, there's a lot going on that has nothing to do with horror. You know, like I talk a lot about, like, if you can take the genre elements out of a movie and keep those characters and their dilemmas, I think all the classic horror movies do that. Like Carrie is a great example. Like, she doesn't need powers for that movie to work. It makes the movie better. And helps illuminate what that book and movie is talking about. And so I think, getting primed by my family and by church to be like, there's deeper hidden meanings in that. I think that just intrigued me and I wanted to find the deeper hidden meanings because I was rebellious.
Yeah.
But then instead of finding what I was promised, I found actual meat on the bone.
Sure.
So what do your parents think of your work now?
I don't really know.
Okay.
No, I mean, it's complicated. I mean, there's some things where I know my parents would never, you know, there, I have I definitely have a variety of R-rated material in there. But then they would struggle a lot with. I mean, I think it's kind of a it's probably just baffling to them more than anything. Like they texted me this week because they were excited for me, and they saw pictures of me at one of the screenings and stuff like that. I don't know if they watch the stuff, but at the same time, it's like I don't. It's just so not who they are.
Yeah.
That it's not an issue or anything like that. It's sure. Like, I don't know what another example would be. I think it is, there's like a bafflement of how I was raised. And then I'm producing Cocaine Bear, which coincidentally wound up shooting like 20 minutes from where my parents live overseas.
Oh, no way.
Which is a very, fun, like, homecoming. I'm coming home because I'm making a giant movie, and the movie is called Cocaine Bear, but it's based on a true story.
Yeah.
But we don't really pay attention to the true story at all. So,
Well, I will say, like, you know, we have like 4 kids and we raise them all the same and they're all so different.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm just like, how is this possible? Like, you know, our second is just crazy. And I'm like, where does he get this from? It's not me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My wife and I have not like intentionally raised our kids like specifically gendered or like any of the stereotype stuff. Mm-hmm. And they are so hardcore. Like the girl is like pink princess unicorn glitter. And the boy's like dinosaurs, lions. Roar. It's like so could not be more. And there's a little overlap. Like he really likes Frozen because his sister loves Frozen. But it's like just so funny how like they like are exactly the stereotypes. And for all of us trying to be like, you know, the edgy, cool, liberal parents that are like, we're going to, you know, raise them neutral. And it's like they instantly just claim their personas. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So what did your path to becoming a screenwriter look like? Was it something that you just started doing or something you ended up pursuing through school?
Definitely. I went to school for it. And I think it stemmed out of, as my family moved to Ireland to do missionary work in 1995. And so that was like a cutoff of a lot of pop culture for me. I was really obsessed with essentially pop culture before leaving the States. And it wasn't like they were like banning it. It was like we lived in the middle of farmland Ireland. And they had like at the time they had 2 channels on Irish TV and did not play a lot of anything. And then the nearest movie theater was like an hour and a half away or something. And then like my parents would never take me anyway.
How old were you around this time?
I was 9.
Oh, wow.
But I would know, I knew, like, The Lost World was the big one. I knew, like, that was coming out, but I had no way of seeing it. And so I think it started, like, having me, and I was very lonely, and just because it's so different from Pennsylvania. But it started getting me into basically writing fan fiction of, like, what I thought The Lost World could be, and this was before internet. Was really a thing. And so I got really into that without knowing about the fan fiction world. And then I think it's like when you play guitar, like you start off playing Dylan songs and then you're like, oh, but these 2 chords go well together and has nothing to do with Bob Dylan. And then you start getting into writing your own stuff. And so it kind of became that where I was like, oh, I like this. And then I remember finding out, knowing about screenwriting because of like the Making of Jurassic Park book. And then really loving the idea of, I mean, I always wanted to be a director, but then I had no money and it's so hard to do anything without money, but you can write without money. And so I like with freehand screenplays. And then I went to back to the States for college where it was screenwriting and now here I am.
The rest is history. So I know like along the way there's a spec screenwriter, and forgive me for my ignorance with that. What exactly is a spec writer?
Yeah. A spec is a script that you write completely on your own. So like no studio knows it exists, basically. So there's the difference of that is like there's also OWAs, which are open writing assignments, where like a studio would own the rights to Harry Potter and be like, Stephen Cloves, can you adapt this for us?
Got it.
Which is a more common, well, it depends on the era of the industry, but it's a very common thing, or if people want the job. And the upside of writing a spec is that you can take it anywhere.
Yeah.
And try to sell it anywhere. And the downside is everyone can say no. And then the upside is a bunch of people can say yes, and then it jacks the price way up.
Right.
So there's a lot more creative freedom beforehand. And then you get a little bit of control about like where this could potentially go if you have good suitors, versus if there's an adaptation or, you know, Bob Iger has an idea that he wants someone to write up. 30 people go up for that job and one person gets it. So it gives you some ownership because you don't get paid if you don't get a job.
Sure, sure.
So that's essentially what it is.
It's got like, it.
You know, you're alone and hoping, you know, your demo tape makes it.
Right. Yeah. Does it have almost that like lotto ticket feeling with everybody kind of doing it as well?
Yeah.
Like,
well, a lot of people don't do it.
Yeah.
Just because it can be such a crap shoot. So, sure. And I think things like the Blacklist kind of help bring it to the fore again. Like there's times where it just kind of dissipates, and then it kind of rises back in popularity. And so, yeah, but there is definitely a lotto element to it. But it's what I've almost always typically done. And I love it because I also just never really get those jobs that I go up for.
Sure.
And I feel like I always have the problem where I'll explain an idea. Like you can also pitch and maybe they'll buy the pitch and then you write it. And I feel like almost every time I would pitch something, no one would be into it. And then I would write it. And most of the time, then people would be into it. So I was like, oh, I'm really bad at talking, but I'm okay at writing. And so, you know, I need to make money somehow.
Yeah. What, like, I'm just curious about the creative process with doing something like that, where you are writing, you're pouring yourself into it, you're toiling over this script, you put it out there, something might happen, something might not, but then you go back and you do it again and again and again. Where do you get the drive to keep going? And this is a good one for anyone listening who's
money.
Attempting to do it. It's money.
No, I mean, a lot of it, I'm lucky enough now that it less so. But for the first while, it was deaf. That was deaf. I mean, I know I love writing, but the drive was, I remember I had gotten my first script had sold, which I'd written a ton of things before that. And that was even an older script by the time it had sold. And then I wrote like a new spec and everyone was very excited because I was the hot young thing. And I remember there's just like a ton of buzz about the new spec, and we went out with it, and within like 48 hours it was dead. Like no one bought it. And then I was terrified. Cause I didn't get I got out of a lot of debt with my first script, but I wasn't like thriving.
Right.
And then it was like, oh, that one didn't sell. Like, what if I have to go back to working at Lucky Brand Jeans?
Right.
And so that really lit a fire under my ass. And I was just like, I better just keep, like, I was desperate to not go back.
Yeah.
Cause you know, you work so hard to get to that level of, or just any kind of success. And then, getting to the point then when you have it and you're like, oh, but it can stop
right
like immediately. It's not fuck you money. And so then that was a huge motivating thing where I was writing so much, just because I was like, I can't go back.
Sure,
like I
sure.
was very scared of, being in debt, and it was right after the recession and it was just an awful time to be like a young kid with like no fallback and no money like at all.
Yeah.
And so I was very grateful when my script sold, and then very terrified when the second one didn't. And then I got really aggressive with writing.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to shift gears to aliens.
Aliens. Yeah.
There we
yeah.
go.
Laura wants to get right into it because we got to pick her son up at soccer.
I know. Damn soccer.
Aliens take on, man.
Yeah. Let's do the aliens. Let's do the aliens. All right. All right. So we're going to get into it now. You got to tell us about how you came up with this one.
Yeah. Well, it happened to me. No, in terms of the alien component of it, I love alien movies. It's definitely like a big passion of mine. And then I'd always kind of had this inkling of an idea, or even just like the nerdy part of my brain with friends when you talk about, like, you know, if they're out there and are they here already and all that kind of stuff. And I've never really bought into like them. They're here in hiding. Cause I'm like, it would be such a monumental achievement to get here.
Yeah.
That it feels like, why just like hide? Like, you're kind of like, that's the hardest thing. Like, humanity has never come close to doing something like that. So the idea of like a massively superior species coming all this way and then, like, you know, hiding in the woods or
underwater.
Yeah. Or any of these different things. Yeah. Like Sphere. It just kind of felt more to me, and a lot of alien movies kind of have a lot of the, like, is it an alien or is it like the neighbor boys pulling pranks on us?
Right.
I think like Nope does a really fun way of subverting that idea too. But it also, and then you usually have a little bit of money that you can show a little bit of alien at the end. And it's like, it's really aliens. And to me, I was like, if they're got all the way here, like, they don't care about like personal privacy and like, oh, the door is locked. Like, oh shit. Like, they should just walk in.
Yeah.
And that was always a place I wanted to start a movie where it's like, yeah, they got here and they're here. And then it's like, we don't really care that there's a 20-year-old girl in this house. Like, we're interested in what's in the house. Like, we'll walk in. And they're not, you know, hiding or playing games. I love all those movies. But I was like, I haven't seen a movie where they do just walk in. And then that's the problem. Yeah.
It's terrifying. And I mean, also with what's going on, obviously it couldn't be more topical and scary, because now, I mean, 5 years ago, we were talking about this the other night, 5 years ago, this would still have a terrifying effect, obviously, but it just rings all that more possible now. Like, it's that veil of science fiction is disappearing. That's crazy.
And it felt more innocent.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, I was telling someone the other day, it's like there's like the Tom DeLong, you know, the Blink-182 guy.
Yeah.
And it was like, for 5 years ago, he was just a nut job. You know, everyone was just kind of like, well, yeah, he left Blink because he's fucking crazy.
Right. It was
about
like
aliens.
The punchline of a joke for a while.
And then now he's like, yeah, told you so. And everyone's like, yeah, Tom's like a prophet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really, like, even that's just so deeply changed in the last 5 years that it's been so.
That's because, you know, it was those WikiLeaks emails. His name pops up in those emails. You're looking at Hillary Clinton and the voting and Trump and all that. And all of a sudden, it's like Tom DeLong talking to this general or the head of Lockheed. And you're like, what?
It's so crazy. And then the responses are like, we don't know. Instead of being like, no, Blink-182 guy, like, fuck off.
Right,
like, they're kind of like engaging with him. And then that's when you're like, something's up. And then as like the videos were coming out and stuff, it was just so, I mean, good for him. But the last 5 years have definitely changed.
Oh,
things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what is your take on aliens now, today, like this day? Like, do you think, because I mean, there's so many theories about interdimensional beings. And
David Grush, what he's saying to Congress and all that stuff.
Yep. I have to believe they exist, because if they don't, we're as good as it gets, which is bleak. I don't know if I think I probably lean either in that they're not here yet, because like this movie does. It's like, why aren't they just like, why are they shy? Like, I'm like, you show off. And then I think it's something like the aliens could be something similar to something like Annihilation, where they aren't really cognizant. Like, they're alive, but not cognizant in like a normal Or at least in a human way of thinking of what normal is. And so what I love about Annihilation is that they kind of are oblivious to the fact of what they're doing. They just know that they're doing something. And I could go along with that. But in terms of like them hiding out or like the ship videos are crazy. But like I would probably almost lean more towards it's like time travel bullshit than UFOs. Like I'm trying to come up with like a really good reason for why they're just like zipping around the ocean and not engaging.
Right.
Like it just seems like they're so far advanced. Like it just suggests that they are extremely nice and don't care, but they did all the work to get here. So I haven't seen a winning argument yet.
No, I get it. Yeah. I get it.
Well, I think in 2027, is that what it is, Leo, that they're supposed to be
the unveiling?
Yeah.
Apparently. Yeah. Allegedly. Yeah.
I feel like it'll be like the JFK stuff where it's like every time it comes up, they're like, yeah, let's add.
Exactly. Yeah, like, exactly. Like, how many times is the world supposed to end?
Like remember, the Mexican mummy babies?
Yeah.
I didn't buy into that for a second.
As soon as it was unveiled, I was like, oh my God, this is it. The coffins they were like, and stuff.
That was, but then they look like shit.
Yeah.
But then, like, the way they were, like, showing them is, like, they picked them up by, like, the waist and were just kind of, like, doing this, which I know no one on the podcast can see.
But like, I was a like, paper mache piece of art or something.
Yeah, it's like, these are. If this is real and people believe this is real, this is literally the most valuable thing that's ever been on the planet.
Right.
And good point. It's like you take better care of some of the props in your house than they're taking care of these mummy babies. Yeah. And so I was like, I don't know, guys, this feels, I'm not sure I'm on board with this.
Now, in developing what the aliens look like and acted like, was there a lot of deep diving on your part to, you know, in terms of research, or was it just kind of what you've absorbed?
Yeah, I think more what I absorbed. I think the only thing I actually watched that I hadn't seen before was the McPherson tapes.
I've seen them.
It's like a pre Blair Witch, found footage thing of like, there's like a family and then aliens, land, and they're like, you know, with their VCR camcorder, like filming this thing. And someone was like, yeah, there's a scene where the aliens walk into the house, like how I had been talking about. I was like, oh fuck, I gotta watch this. And it happens at the very end, and it's great. It's really great. And it's like early 90s found footage. So it's like a very different and like a $20 budget kind of thing. That was the only thing, but that was pretty deep in, because I told a couple of people, I was like, it starts with aliens walking in the house, and they were like, someone was like the McPherson tapes. But yeah, beyond that, it was like, I knew I wanted to use the grays because I just really missed them in pop culture. Like I felt like people had steered away from them for so long.
For sure.
And I knew my character was going to need faces to act opposite. And that's such a, you know, great face. And it just seems stupid to try to like top that face. And then knowing that they were going to show up early, it was like, okay, if it's something recognizable, then I can have a lot of fun with, like, you know, adding cherries on top and giving them subspecies and all that kind of stuff. And I really wanted them to talk a lot, which I feel like the grays never talk in movies. And so that felt like a really fun opportunity to come up with language and religion and all that.
Oh my gosh. So did you go deep on that stuff? Like, is there a language? Does all those things actually mean?
Yeah. It's not like a one to like, we talked about like what they were saying, but it's not like, I never like wrote it out, but there's like repeated, sounds that they, or repeated like music or speech that they make that are repeated for a reason. But yeah, that was part of the fun of it. That's was like, because I also wanted, I felt like a lot of alien movies, again, like they're smart enough to get here, but then when they get here, they just are kind of like big dogs, or they're just like boogeymen.
Yeah,
like they're not like, these are the smartest things that have ever existed.
Right.
And so wanting to, as much as I could, play with that, well, keeping them scary too, but have it feel like, yo, these guys are smart motherfuckers.
How did you come up with their voice? It's so scary.
Yeah, it's like terrifying.
Oh, cool.
Man.
Yeah, I was like, oh. God.
No, that's, and I can't tell where voice begins and score ends. Like,
there's a lot of music in their voice. Yeah. But the sound design is by Chris Terhune and Will Files, who do all of Matt Reeves' stuff. They just got nominated for the Batman. And that was, you know, a movie like this is, I think, really appealing to crew because it's every department gets to really show off in this movie. And so I think they were just super excited. And I would just get like, you know, MP3s that were like 5 minutes long of just different noises. And then it would be like, oh, I love that. Like the little like bong bong they do in the movie. Yeah. Like that was in like one of the first ones. And I was like, that sounds weird and cool and musical and like definitely like when you would remember that it was said before and then it gets said again. And then they just kind of built it out from there. They came up with so much cool shit. Like they have one of the things we talked about with the visual effects guys is like the alien kind of uses its fingers like a radar.
Yeah.
Like, so you'll see a couple of times. It's not like super upfront, but like if he walks into a room, he'll kind of move his finger around and then he hears or spots or feels something, he'll like kind of point and then his body kind of goes after where he points. And the guys were like, oh, like we should put like a little bone rate. So there's like that like click, 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 click kind of thing. That's his finger like radaring. And like that came up like late in post. And I was just like, oh, that's fucking great. But yeah, those guys are absurd talented.
Oh, so everybody was just throwing in their ideas and concepts.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's what I love about directing is it's just, you kind of start building like a family of repeat offenders, that you bring so many ideas that are better than what I could have thought of on my own. And so it was just so exciting to work with Chris and Will or Joe Trapanese, the composer, or everybody really. And then they would do something and you're like, oh shit, like that's the coolest. I'm going to get so much praise for this.
Oh, you know, I was really curious if you were inspired by a Twilight Zone episode. There's an episode called The Invaders.
I'm such a fucking idiot. I forgot all about it until someone brought it up a couple weeks ago. And then I like the sinking feeling of like, is that where this idea came from?
No, but it shares some parallels. And of course, we don't want to reveal the big plot.
Yeah. Point, yeah, no, I did college, like, you know, that like New Year's Eve Twilight Zone marathons and all that stuff. And then it was as soon as like someone said it, I was like, I haven't seen it probably for 20 years, but then they said it, I was like, I knew exactly what the fuck they were talking about. So I have to go back and just see if I just rip them off. I'm terrified now to go back. Terrified.
Not at all, but
a couple, like 2 weeks ago, someone said it and I had that just awful acid in my stomach, just being like, oh my God. What have I done?
No, you're good, man. You're good.
It felt like a good inspiration, but you know,
I'm sure I 100% have seen it, and then just it did not pop into my brain at all, and I'm very embarrassed. But I feel like my memory, like since COVID and since having kids, I feel like my memory went from like 100% to like 20%.
Oh, like, dude, I'm the exact same way.
left and right. Exactly. So I have no idea.
Are you taking? Do you have to go? Yeah. Okay, Lauren's taken off for a bit. Maybe she'll come back. We might still be here. Who knows?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Well, it's been great having you for the aliens and. She was so excited to talk aliens with you, man. She's been obsessed. Like she couldn't walk, dude, after we watched this movie. Because it was everything that she's been thinking about and hearing about for the past like couple months all on screen. It was like this must be what it would be like if this actually is all real.
I'll take it.
Man. I wanted to talk about Joe Trapanese. You've worked with him before, right?
Yeah,
on Spontaneous. Was this Spontaneous your first time you worked with him?
Theoretically, so the only job I've ever gotten that wasn't a spec was I did one of the Divergent movies.
Yes.
And which super fun experience and everything. And then at the premiere, I took my buddy Dave Green was directing Ninja Turtles 2. He came with my wife and I to the premiere. And he was excited to go because he's a good friend, but also because Joe Trapanese had scored his first movie, Earth to Echo, and that also had scored Insurgent. And so I met Joe Trapanese at the premiere for the movie we worked on and hit it off. And then when Spontaneous came around, I didn't think I could afford him, so I didn't reach out. And he called me and was like, I know you're finished filming. I really want to see it. And I was like, would you do it? And he's like, hell yeah. And I was like, oh, well, you're hired.
Nice.
So, and then it was, and then, you know, our friendship grew from there. And everything I've done since, that I've written or directed, he's done and will continue to do. Yeah.
He's unbelievable.
Yeah,
and the
really
score
sick.
In this one, I mean, it comes on, it's so guttural,
yeah.
Nightmarish, like those swells, like
yeah.
Like they just come every once in a while.
That's
it's like, holy fuck, it's so cool.
Yeah.
Did he come up with that? Did you sit in? How was that decided
he's one of the first people to read my stuff. So he was always involved. And then we had heard a couple examples of composers doing some score before movie starts shooting, which is unusual because usually you get like 7 paid weeks or something.
Sure.
And then everyone wants to save that for the end. But because Joe and I are now buds, he really wanted to write a lot of music before we started shooting. And then it's a lot of the same themes and stuff that's in the movie now. It was so useful, especially, you know, and again, this is a show off piece for Joe.
Sure.
But so I think he was excited about doing probably a little bit of extra work. But it was exciting because, you know, Caitlin Deaver could hear the score. The crew could hear the score, like the head of the studio heard the score.
Wow. It's a part of their creative process. It was all embedded.
But then
in.
It was like everyone knew the tone. Like everyone kind of got like what the feel of the movie was.
Yeah.
And then some scenes changed because I was like, I love how that sounds. I don't know where it could go. But and then it would be like, but it would be really cool. So there's like a scene where Caitlin's back home and knows that the aliens are coming back and kind of grits her teeth and then starts barricading her home. And there's like a very smaller version of that. And it's not like a huge scene, but like Joe wrote that music and Caitlin and I were both like, it feels like that's the music for like when this would happen. But it's not in the script. And so we put it into the script because we were like, well, we got to use that track because it's sick. But it feels like you're kind of like psyching yourself up. And it's like, da, 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 da. So it was the coolest way of working. And I won't work that way. I won't not work that way again because it just was so, it just made everything so much easier.
Sure.
I mean, I'm sure it's a nightmare for him to be like, and you're going to do all this work at the start as well. But I think he had a good time with it. And so, I mean, so much of it's in the movie. Like Bryn's theme is Caitlin heard that like months before we started shooting. It was really awesome.
That moment that's after, again, try not to spoil anything because it's such a movie that is so fun to experience knowing as little as possible going in. But there is a sound that happens after a bus scene. That sounds like almost like a jumping rope.
Oh, yeah.
Is that score or is that?
Yeah, that's
Foley?
Score.
That's score.
Yeah. Oh, he has, there's a bunch so cool. of, he wrote like liner notes for the album and it like talks, and I've seen the instruments and stuff, and it's like, they're very strange. And
wow.
We talked a lot about them being like it feeling like organic.
Yeah.
And giving like the aliens like kind of like weird, like rhythm, like, feel like, and
yeah.
like we're time signature kind of shit. Like I'm not a music guy. Like I don't know how to talk about music,
sure.
rather. But so it's a lot of strange instruments that he found and would fuck with. And remember there's like, he went to some warehouse full of like instruments and they had like a forklift pull down like this strange instrument
that's awesome.
That he like then used. That's kind of like a xylophone, but it's not a xylophone. I don't know what it's fucking called. But it was cool. But I think that was what was exciting about the movie is because everyone was kind of like, oh, we got to do cool shit. And it was like doing like really like swinging for the fences and doing things that I think on other movies they wouldn't have felt allowed to do. And part of that is because that's the kind of director I am. But also part of that is that it's not a very chatty movie. So everyone was just kind of like, well, it's, you know, Joe is basically playing Caitlin's brain. as the score for the whole movie. And so it's so exciting.
You're right. I mean, everyone has to tell a story, even the wardrobe, right? Because of the lack of dialogue, right?
Yeah. Like the wardrobe, that was a huge thing about her character is someone who dresses down when they go out of the house and then dresses up when they get back home, which is so antithetical to everyone else. And like almost like the nicest she looks is when she's in bed.
Yes.
In pajamas. And that being like a very specific character reveal, like when you think about like, and you, by the time you finish the movie, like, and you're thinking about like, why is that what she's doing? It makes a lot of sense. But it being like a really fun way to tell that story very quickly visually, where you're like, oh, she looked fine when she was out, but
right,
then she comes home and all of a sudden is dressed up alone. And she doesn't seem crazy. And so it felt, yeah, so like every department got to tell backstory that's not really explained in the text of the movie, but can be talked about at length if you so choose.
And that's that part of the mystique that's in the movie. As a viewer, a lot of this stuff isn't answered, but you're glued. You almost have the audience is forced to have this childlike curiosity about what's happening. It seems to be. It's unsettling because everything seems to be out of time, if that makes sense.
You
know, like, when is this happening? Why do people look like this? What is their intent? What is she going to do? And it keeps you just glued to your seat. There's this big element of mystique. Can you talk a little bit about just using the element of mystique to engage an audience, the kind of magic that invokes?
Yeah, well, it was the idea of, firstly, you only get, you know, like 5 minutes with Caitlin before shit hits the fan.
Yeah.
And so she has to really make an impression. And with Caitlin, it's so easy because it's Caitlin. So she makes an impression without all of our bells and whistles. But then she is a very complicated and interesting character outside of Aliens. And so then it just became a matter of like when you dig into some of the reveals and the backstories about her, you know, Ramsey Avery, our production designer, and I talked a lot about, you know, she is a 10-year-old's idea of what a 30-year-old is, because there was a big kind of gap in her adolescence. And, you know, her mom, like we have very in-depth backstories, but part of the movie is that she is self-isolating essentially, and thinks she will grow old and die in this house and is trying to find a way to feel good and feel happy. And a part of that is she's building a world all of her own. And it was like, well, that's the, like, if I can't ever leave, like similar to your wonderful house, like I'm going to make it the things that make me happy. And it doesn't have to make sense in a 2023 kind of way. And then every now and again, you'll see like a flat screen TV. And I joked the other day, it's because, you know, she loves old movies and she wants to see old movies as good as they can be seen, not like on a shitty tube box. But that was the intention. It's like, you know, she's, you know, on Etsy, she's handcrafting a lot of stuff herself. And she's just being like, okay, this is where I will die someday. And it'll probably take months for someone to even find my body when I die. But I'm going to try to make it a world that gives me everything I need so I don't have to go out and can be happy in this existence. And so there's a lot of that storytelling in that house that, again, I think it throws people for a loop at first because you're kind of like, she seems kind of kooky, but not like quite manic pixie. Dream girl, like it's not for show, like it's so insular of a thing, and so it takes people a while, and then again that's never really articulated like everything in the movie, but that being like a very specific thing that Caitlin was acting from and that Ramsey was building off of, and then by the end of the movie it's very very it's very big. The example, like where that design choice goes, I guess.
The Boo Crew will be right back. There are 4 billion people on Earth. 237 are scanners. They have the most terrifying powers ever created. And they are winning. Scanners. Their thoughts can kill. Scanners. Rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent.
look like.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're wearing a director's hat, a writer's hat, and you have to bring to life, you know, these elaborate paranormal scenes where stuff's flying around the room, refrigerator, this, that, fighting, hiding, ducking, yeah, running. I mean, I get how a director can take that and say, hey, okay, so they fight. The director, right, you know, the director will, you know, choreograph it or whatever, right? But here, you have to put it together in such a way that it's got to make sense to the visual effects people too as well, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, is your script really detailed as to what happens in the movie?
It's detailed in terms of beats. And so it's a lot of white on the page. And then it's the way I write, and I write this when it's a talkie too. But it's kind of like every line is essentially like a shot or a beat. So it might be like, you know, she hides behind the refrigerator, and then the next line is takes a deep breath. Next line is slowly starts to lean forward, kind of thing. So that you're kind of building momentum on the page. And then I totally throw it the fuck out sometimes. Like, so there's a scene where she is paralyzed, essentially, and it's all of the whole page just says she can't move, like without space in between the words, just over and over again. And then it's in between, like every like third line of that, like shining madness, it'll say like, and then she sees feet appear, and then it's like that. So it's like giving you a weird feeling of what the movie, for me, the script should feel like how the movie should feel. So then no one's like, it feels so different. Like it was trying very specifically to be like, you know, we don't have dialogue. And so it has to be clear. It's like, Caitlin is confused about why this is happening. It's not like we're being obtuse. It's that Caitlin doesn't know. So we don't know. And that's part of the terror of it. And so I could even articulate that probably better on the page, just cause I've been writing longer than directing. But it's like, 90 page script. But yeah, it's meant to be, as evocative of the movie as possible. And then a ton of things changed and got added or subtracted, but yeah, for me, it's meant to be detailed enough so that you can close your eyes and be like, this is a movie. Yeah.
That's one of my favorite scenes that you're talking about, by the way. Loved it so much.
Yeah.
I wanted to know, what was it like watching Caitlin, watching her process kind of tell an entire story with her eyes and body movement, and watching your script come to life in that way through her? I mean, to be there and see that must have been an extraordinary thing.
Yeah, it's
thing.
So cool. I mean, just, I love actors. I mean, we're talking about Catherine Langford earlier because of your Knives Out collection. And I just love working with her on Spontaneous. And it's like, that's the thing, I think, for writers that become directors, is sometimes like the most daunting part, where you're like, I have to fucking talk to people. And on top of that, you have to talk to movie stars. Like, I remember I cast Piper Perabo in Spontaneous, and I was very nervous to talk to her because I love Piper Perabo. And she's so cool, and it was awesome, but I was just like, it was the kind of one of the casting things, like, she got cast and then I never talked to her until she was in front of me.
That's got to be weird. Yeah.
Yeah. So like that, and that is not my personality to like talk to people. The coolest thing about actors is you get to be upfront with them in a way that you usually aren't as a writer.
Sure.
And you just get to see the magic show. And it's so crazy what these people can do. And it's just like, you just fall in love with acting because it is just like I would be a terrible production designer, but I could bullshit my way into having a conversation about how it's done.
Yeah.
Would never try to be one, but it's like, it wouldn't be hard for me to like do a podcast about production design. Acting is, I'm like, I don't understand. Like, this is as alien to me as an
alien
would be.
It seems to come from nowhere.
It's just, it's so baffling. And Caitlin is so good. So there's that, where it's just like every day you're like, well, and I've been so lucky in both my movies. I've never had like the actor where I have to like really pull performance from. Like, I've just been like, I've just gotten these bangers like nonstop. And Caitlin, it was just like, you know, take one, it's good. Take two is good. Like, honestly, we would do like, have to do multiple takes because like clouds covered something. Sure. You know, it's like stuff like that. It was never like Caitlin. So there's that aspect of it. And then in terms of the no dialogue thing, you know, because you're shooting shot to shot, it doesn't feel in the moment different, you know, because a lot of action or a lot of, movies don't have someone talking necessarily. Like it can be like, okay, you're going to go from the left side of the room to the right side of the room because there's someone entering the house, and it takes 2 seconds to, you know, it's 2 seconds worth of film. And you're like, well, yeah, of course she wouldn't talk in that moment. And then it would be mostly in, as we were winding down the shoot, and then our editor was kind of starting to work on the movie. That's when it became like, oh, there's really no fucking talking. Like, so that became, and then it became Caitlin. What Caitlin was doing was more impressive because she was tracking everything so specifically in a way that I feel like I probably need to get better at as a director. Although I probably won't have a similar example or a similar scenario to this movie on another movie, but it was that she's able to track and she kind of knows my eyes were doing this 3 days ago. Now that,
yeah, that
this
emotional continuity
kind of thing. And, you know, as I'm looking more big picture on the day, and then the performance is great. So I'm like, it'll, you know, I'm not the biggest stickler for like, it has to match kind of thing. As long as if it's good, it's good, you know? And then it would match, and you, I would be like, oh shit, like Caitlin is really just, I would, sometimes you move scenes around, or shots around like that, like a shot that might've been fourth planned might suddenly become the second shot, in post. And like Caitlin would always call it out. She's like, that wasn't the performance I was giving on the day. Like that was supposed to be later. And you're like, dude, like
that is
only you will ever notice. But it's also crazy that like 9 months later, you're like, my eyes are telling a different story.
Sure. And that she cares. enough.
Yeah,
too.
And she's a producer on the movie, too. But it's just like, you're just like, again, you're just like, I mean, there's like tons of shit in the movie that I care like that about. But with Caitlin, it's just like, you know, like you remember where your eyes are.
It's all the feeling, nuance. Yeah.
And you know what that looks like. Like, I wouldn't know. I see a picture of myself and I get confused, let alone like if I'm watching myself in a movie and then being like, well, it works, but like the shots that if you use a later shot than it's supposed to be. So it's not quite what it's playing. And you're just like, it's like, and it'd be like a you know, close up of her face.
She helped in the editing process? Was she like, hey, you know what?
Well, I would tell her it's fine. Yeah. I'd be like, I would push back a little bit on those kind of notes. Sure. And she wasn't like, you have to change anything like that. But I always was just amused. And I think she knew I was amused and then kept telling me what had happened. But yeah, no, she gave tons of notes the whole.
That's incredible.
The whole time.
Nice.
And is, yeah, I mean, but she's, it's very literally her movie. So, you know, I think, not that she was I don't think she was concerned, but it just felt like it would be crazy if I was like, oh, here's the finished movie. Bye. Yeah. You know, it just, and also cause I just got to know and value her so much while shooting. And she just had so many amazing ideas that are in the movie that it was just kind of like, why? Yeah. Like you're going to make the movie better, you know, in post. So please help me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of like the video, visual effects, this movie made me think of Lee Whannell's The Invisible Man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's a kitchen scene.
Oh, that's cool.
The fight scene.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't find out till what, 6 months later, how it was done. And they showed there was a guy wearing a green suit that was literally picking up Elizabeth Moss off the ground and tossing her. I'm like, holy shit. Like, I thought it was all like a wires and she's banging around. But it's like, that blew my mind, you know? So I kept thinking about this movie. I'm like, how are some of these scenes, like there's paranormal stuff where we don't see the grays and then there are the grays and there's this destruction and things opening, closing and moving. And
yeah.
Like how were some of these effects done? Was it somebody in suit or was it all just visual?
We had
effects?
A little bit of everything for all the different scenarios. It, you know, we had a guy in the blue leotard and you shoot plates with him and then you shoot plates without him as if he wasn't there. And then we would have some of the stunt rigging where it's like, you know, he's interacting with this. So we have to have a wire pull something, but like the scene where he like, puts the phone back on the receiver. It's like we shot like a phone getting picked up and put back on, and then I think the phone is CG now, but it's based on the shot of the phone getting put back on. But yeah, it's like it's all the different tricks of the trade, and there's sometimes where it's you know, so they're literally physically like interacting with Caitlin, and so that's like a person in a suit. But then we also have, like, there's a scene where an alien falls on top of Caitlin, and she had to do a take where a man falls on top of her, and she's struggling with that. And then we had to do a scene where there's no man on top of Caitlin, but she has to act like she, like a, you know, 150-pound man has fallen on top of her. And it was incredible. And again, like speaking of the acting superpower, like it's always like she was very like, this is going to look really silly. And then testing the movie looked very silly. But and then by the end of it, you're like, you never think about it. But, you know, it's everything we could do. And then our budget's not big either. And so a lot of it was very planned out because it would be like, OK, like this alien scene or the set piece can only afford 5 shots of the alien. And then you're kind of working backwards about like, OK, well, I have 5 shots and it has to be so clear and so cleanly told that it has to work, you know, like I can't. So there's not a lot of bullshit camera twirly stuff in here. Part of it is probably fear on my behalf of being like, hey, that's going to cost more. And it's more time to shoot. And I only have 5 shots. And if that shot is really cool, will it distract somebody from understanding what's going on? Because they're just like, oh, that camera is really cool. And then will they just get lost? Because there's not going to be Caitlin being like, and this is why that's happening. And so it became very... like, okay, we got to just be really blunt with the camera because people need to be able to follow it. And then also, it was always meant for Hulu. And so knowing that, you know, in like an hour, people are going to watch it on their phones and shit. It was like, okay, like, how does it look on their phone? So if it's twirly camera stuff, are you like, I have no idea what I'm looking at. As opposed to if you're like, it's a medium of an alien, you're like, I can follow. So it's not necessarily as sexy, but you can understand the story. And then the CG kind of followed suit after that, where it was just kind of like, okay, like these are, we have 5 shots and they have to look blunt and like look like this. And we have to understand everything Caitlin's character is understanding in this scene. And that if we get a little too fancy, it's going to be a problem. Or it could be a problem because I can't get people back once you lose them on this movie because there's not that ADR moment. And so it just became, it sounds complicated and stressful, but it's the most fun. Too, where you're just like, you know, 5 shots of an alien. Like, what are
let's
they going to
think
be?
Of it? Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Let's make him. Let's make everyone a home run.
It's funny. Yeah. Trevor, Lauren, and I were talking, and we were discussing how the little things of the set design of our house made us feel uncomfortable.
Oh, cool.
Like, we thought of what is the movie reference? It Follows, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, It Follows has some weird thing.
Oh, yeah, where it's like a weird future.
Yeah,
yeah, kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We're
yeah.
Like, she's got a rotary phone. I already feel disturbed. I'm like, fuck. There's nobody letting you online that knows what that is.
Yeah, the rotary phone thing that we talked. It's and I'm curious now that it's coming out. How many people are gonna be like, where's her fucking cell phone? Yeah. We had a bee where she had like a cell phone like hidden like in a drawer, but it was, the battery was dead, and then there's no power in the house. But it was for us. It was this idea of, like a 30, like again the 10-year-old wanting to be a 30-year-old. It's like a lot of people would be like, no phone at the dinner table, like none of that kind of stuff. So she's probably, there's an element where it's like uncouth to have a cell phone. But then also because of her backstory and because of how the town feels about her, it's similar to how I feel about reading reviews and comments, where it's like, it's a very dangerous, slippery slope to be on Twitter and be like Bryn Adams and see what pops up. And so it just became a matter of like, she has a computer that she uses for work. And it stays in that room and it never leaves that room. And then it just became like, okay, without the internet, like I there's temptations to be masochistic that I don't have. And I don't have an online presence. So people probably won't find out who I am. And so it just kind of, it stemmed from that. And then it was just like, oh yeah. But then absolutely, you know, you can have so much fun with the rotary phone because you get the classic like tap, tap, tap. Oh, the phone line's gone. Because that's the first thing you think of is like call for help. But then also like you don't, an alien's not picking up a cell phone, but you, the scene in the movie where like the phone freaks out at her, she drops it, and then the alien like calmly picks up and puts it back on the receiver. You're like, that feels like a movie as opposed to if it was a fucking iPhone on the ground and an alien picked it up. You're like, you know.
Exactly.
And also like, we had a bunch of cell phones because I was teenagers and spontaneous, and it's the fucking worst. It is so awful to shoot. And it's so boring. Like it's every version of it's terrible.
They have to fucking green screen their phones or do whatever, program what goes on them, show them what you're going
to
show.
Yeah, and then
reflections.
It just became like, oh, I'm going to have to do scenes where she's plugging in plugs.
Yeah.
and the phone's not charging, and is the phone broken, or like it just was like it's just like so much weird legwork.
Yeah.
As opposed to, and they, but also we came to the rotary phone because of a character place, as opposed to, and then like the fun of the scare and everything came from that, as opposed to it being like, well, I just hate cell phones.
Yeah.
And I do, but, I very early on, I was just like, if she has a phone, she's like a 20-year-old girl who has a very checkered past, and she's just going to Google herself and just hate herself. And so much of the movie, but when we meet her, is she's working really hard to enjoy what little life she thinks she deserves. And so that was important to just, even in that kind of a character space, just be like, yeah, she's not going to have the internet because the internet is cursed. And we'll just kind of, even beyond that, we'll just remind her of what she doesn't think she deserves in terms of relationships or
sure
porn, or, you know, it's like whatever it could be, you know, that she will not be a part of her life. So why have that hurt in your house?
Yeah.
But then I got to give her the phones.
Yeah. Yeah. It's brilliant. But also like, it also made me think of like, you know, there's a lot of influencers who live like that. Right.
Yeah.
And that like wind back the clock, you know, strip away a lot of tech, live in an old Victorian home with the rotary phone.
Yeah.
With no TV, or it's hidden, you know, so it's.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And it's been funny, like seeing, because the movie doesn't explain itself verbally, how people have been like, it does throw people for a loop where it's just like, it's the period movie. And then but it's not a period movie. And then it is a period movie.
Yeah.
And then it's like,
I love it.
And then it's a flat screen. And it's, I think it's not, and we cut some stuff out of that first few minutes just because it was context for that as opposed to her. And it just all of a sudden you're like, I'm watching a scene that's explaining why she has this big house, you know, because it was her mom, it's where she grew up. And then it just starts, you just start thinking about her mom. And then you start going like, well, is her mom related to Maude? And it just became like, because no one's telling you what to think,
it's awesome
that you were going and people were just going fucking everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it was like, okay, we just have to give people as little to think about as possible. Because there's so much to think about, but it has to be exactly what we're trying to get people to think about. And that was a very tough part of the edit where people were just like, even like, and if I had to do it over, I would probably, I don't know what I would do because it's a complicated thing, but like we try losing like the mom's headstone, at the start of the movie. Cause then the mom was like kind of peppered through it a little bit more just as like an idea of a character. People got so confused by the mom, and then we took out the headstone and no one brought up the house and why she has that house. And we took out the headstone and everyone was suddenly like, are the people mad at her because she's in that house? Like, how does this young girl have this house?
Yeah.
And then just having like her mom is dead at the start made people go, oh, it's probably her mom's house. Like, yeah. It just kind of instantly took away like a question that like cutting it out, you never think about it in a talkie.
Sure.
Because it's like, well, what they're talking about is what we're thinking about.
Exactly. Yeah. They can explain plot points and stuff that way.
Or not
even
explaining it, but just like, this is what they're talking about. So I understand to pay attention to what they're saying. And then without that, people were just, you know, go off like fireworks about 100 different things. And so it was a really, so we even like CG'd the text on the headstone because originally it was like Mother to Bryn, wife of Hugh. And then everyone thought Hugh was going to show up at some point and like save the day, which is probably misogynistic. But like everyone's just like, well, you introduced that there is a dad. And it's like, well, of course there's a fucking dad. Like that's how people work. But just the idea of like this woman was married and like Bryn had a father, just having it articulated and not having a gravestone with him, people were just like at the end of the screenings would just be like, where's her dad? Like the whole movie, it was a setup and it's not a setup. It was the only thing you read in the movie.
So you attached yourself.
And then you didn't have dialogue. And so everyone was just like, where's Hugh? And it's just like, I assume she's married.
Right.
You know?
Right. I loved all those. I loved all those aspects that there was questions and I had to.
Yeah, but it worked. It was a lot of work to get to have people think in the right ballpark.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I get it.
It spawns just so much discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was trying to get it to be good discussion. And because for a while it would just be people making up, because we had to really hold their hand or else they would make up a totally different
movie.
And like, we would test it, and like, some people would just like be talking and you're like, what are you fucking, like, that's not in the movie. Like, scenes, like, they would be like, I hated this scene where this happens. And I'm like, I would probably hate it too. But it's not there. But it's like, people would just, it was like this weird, like, and other people would like agree. And it was like this weird, like, Mandela effect kind of thing where
that's,
it was just
cool,
like
though.
Some kind of pinball happened. And then we had to like work about like, there, I can't remember what the exact scene was, but it was a scene that people hated. That's not, never a shot, never in the movie. And we had to like figure out the chemistry of the cut to be like, why are people thinking this happens? And it was the weirdest thing to like edit out a scene that doesn't exist.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. You're materializing and conjuring scenes.
Yeah, it was really wild. So we did a couple like pickups to change like sentences that are being written, because other sentences that we all thought were blunt were just like making people, you know, twirl away. And then you're just like, oh, we lost them. And we lost them because we mentioned a Hugh.
Yeah.
And you're just like, so people are so gone, and then get so annoyed that Hugh doesn't show up. And it was just stuff like that where you're just like, fuck, okay.
Well, do you have a Bible that where you actually explain every single character detail, like every plot point, everything
with Caitlin? Yeah. Everything with Caitlin is very specific. Right. Cause it was really helpful for Caitlin. And then also the house. So like, you know, if they're like, would she have this? It's like, yes. And we would like, and Ramsey's such a genius, the production designer, because he has stories for everything in the fucking house. Which is never contextualized. But Caitlin can ask. I signed off on the story he was telling. And then with the aliens, it's a little bit more amorphous, because I got nervous about if I wrote out their plan, how human it would feel, because I really wanted it to feel like, I want it to feel alien in a way that like their brain doesn't necessarily have to go A, B, C,
sure.
D. It can be like A, 5, you know, just chaos to a human, but makes sense, total sense to them. And then also because I wanted, like, there's things that they do that are explained, and Caitlin has no idea why things happened for a good reason for her or for a bad reason for her. And that felt like a really good horror place where they're not just attack dogs. Like, sometimes they walk away from her, or sometimes they take like a prayer break, or they don't chase her. And that also being the scary part where she's like, it's not chasing me. Why? Like, that almost becomes scarier, where she's like, is there something else that I need to be afraid of? Because now this guy's just like, oh, later, I'm going to leave. And that being like a really fun, and it felt like very alien of a place, because I feel like a lot of movies, the aliens are like, I'm going to get you. And it felt like, well, what if the alien like left?
Yeah.
And then she's like, am I safe? What do I do? Like, that being like the terror of like the alien leaves for a chunk of the movie at the start. And it's just like, I don't know what to do. Like, am I going to screw myself over by shutting the door that it walked out of? And that just felt like a fun thing that I hadn't seen before. But again, speaking like the thing I gave the effects guys is, I was like, you know, the guy that walks into her house in the opening has a checklist of things to do, and Caitlin is like 9 or 10 on the checklist. Like, there's things that are like more important to him, because he's always wanted to know what like keys are, and he's like, I gotta find out what the fuck these keys are, you know. And that for him is more important than like, I gotta deal with the person. And like, that just felt like a weird alien brain of like, yeah, I traveled all this way, I know what a fucking person is, but like, I haven't seen this stuff before. Like, cool, I want to check it out. And then there's an ant that I'll deal with. And so that felt like trying to be, and that was also push and pull of like, sometimes you lose audiences because they're just like, I don't understand. And trying to find the balance of them being like, I don't understand, it's scary, versus I don't understand because it just feels chaotic. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you definitely landed on that. I don't understand, it's terrifying, because that's kind of like how I would imagine dealing with an alien would be like,
An example of that is like, there's a scene where the first time you kind of see the alien, like, she's at the fridge, and his hands come up on the fridge door, and it's scary. And then we had him start like banging the fridge door in like weird rhythmic patterns, because it just felt weird and scary. And like, he was communicating with her, and he was talking on the other side of it, but you just didn't see him. and I liked it, and it, people just were just like, what the fuck is he doing? Like, and I was like, well, he's, this is, I had like a backstory, and they were like, it's confusing, as opposed to like if he just like peaks.
Yeah.
And then it was like, well, that's a better shot. But it was like finding that rhythm of like, yeah, they're doing weird, dumb shit. Or that feels weird and dumb to us, but for them is very
intent. Everything's intent done with
and specific,
intent.
And makes them feel intelligent. So we had some of that stuff explained out. But like also not really wanting to get into the, like, this is the Grandmaster.
Yeah. That plan. Mystique, you keep the mystique going, which is
great. I know it frustrates some people about the ending, but I was just like, they're not telling Caitlin why the ending is happening.
Right.
And that felt like, you know, that cookie can crumble both ways, where sometimes she doesn't know what's happening and it's very bad for her. And then sometimes she doesn't know what's happening. And why can't it work out in a positive way and throughout the movie sometimes, where they do just leave the room and she has like, you know, it's not like a dumb horror girl moment. Is that what makes this scarier is like if Jason walks in, sees you, and then turns and leaves, you're like, there's probably Freddy behind me.
Yeah,
you know. And then if Freddy's not behind you, it's still, it's just like, why did that happen? And that playing with that fear as opposed to their attack dogs or whatever else. Yeah.
I love that you did that and left it with it's definitely rewarding. It's a rewarding experience as an audience member, as much as you can ponder and meditate on exactly what's going on. There is a big reward to me. You
cool.
know,
good.
To have both is important. I wanted to ask about just the camera shots in particular. There's some beautiful camera work. I mean, cool. Unforgettable moments. There's a couple like really cool split diopter shots that I love, and close-ups on eyes and POV. There's a really frightening POV camera play in one scene. Did you storyboard all those moments out? How did that kind of work? Was there any practical aliens involved in the process
at
all?
There's a little bit of practical. Not as much as I would have loved, but you know, the irony is, it's like we have so much aliens, and then puppets have to do specific things. And so we'd have to have had so many puppets, but then also we were shooting so fast that it became impractical to have puppets, and our very expensive CG just made more sense. And I had a bunch of buddies go through the process where they would have puppets that basically get painted over, which is like a double cost. And we, our aliens changed a bunch what we shot to versus what they wind up doing in the final cut. And we had that flexibility. And it would, more puppets would have been a nightmare, which is too bad. And I do really want to do more puppet work soon, but, not a ton of alien practical, but there is some. And then, in terms of the camera, there's the bigger scenes got post-viz or pre-vizzed, just basically for a financial necessity to be like, how many shots budget wise can we afford of aliens? But you know, it wasn't based on our house or like really on our time schedule. It was just kind of like, this would be cool. And then it was like, you have that, and then you kind of chip away and morph that on the page and on the day. And then a lot of it was with Aaron, my DP, and I just being very specific, like I said, about the twirly camera shit, which I know we're both dying to have fun with. but then also, really wanting it to feel experiential, of a movie, so that it feels like you were holding hands with Caitlin the whole time. And so kind of keeping the camera with Caitlin, so that it kind of stemmed with that POV stuff you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it just felt like, yeah, like this just be very, and like, there's some sexy shit in there for sure, but wanting to just be like, okay, you're just beside Caitlin.
Yeah.
And Aaron's not a fan of like the, like running, you know, he likes a calm, composed camera, and I do too. And it felt like, yeah, let's make it classy. And not too handheld, and just, you know, live in that kind of classic film world. Again, being like, oh, if it's really handheld and Jason Bourne, it'll probably be exciting. But truth of the matter is, you know, I sold this movie to Hulu, and if someone's watching it on their fucking phone, is it just going to be chaos? As opposed to, I see Caitlin, I don't hear anyone talking, but I can see what Caitlin's doing and I understand. And then just that being our guiding factor. Yeah.
Right, and by the way, she totally nailed the Tom Cruise run.
Oh yeah. That was, I told her, I was like, you're going to Tom Cruise. And we talked about Tom Cruise. A ton. And like her big, after the bus, her big run, that was the first day shooting. And I, you know, she's a fit girl. So I'm like, hopefully she can run, but I hadn't seen her run until that shot, of her running from the bus. And then it was kind of, I remember, well, Aaron had COVID, so he was locked in a van, but I remember, kind of everyone being like a little nervous beforehand. Caitlin being like, it's going to be fine, guys. And then she did it and we're all like, it's a movie. Like, yeah, that's, she fucking great. Runs. I think there's like the fear. And then we were having a conversation. It's like, if she runs a little sloppy, it, you know, we'll probably be okay. You know, cause there are actors and actresses that cannot run and they find out on the day. It's like the classic, like, oh, that person can't ride a bike. And you find out that they run and you're just like, oh dear God. I guess happened on stuff I've been a part of. Yeah. And you just like go with it. But I was like, there's so much running. If Caitlin looks goofy, you know, just goofy, we're going to have to really lean into it. Yeah. And then she like took off and we were like, you might not be able to catch her. Even if he was running, like, this is great.
Yeah. That reminds me, remember Sarah Paxton? We talked to her and she revealed that she can't scream. And they'd find out while she's working on a horror movie. She sounds like a Muppet when she screams, that they'd have to figure something out.
I've replaced screams, not with it's funny, like Caitlin and Samara Weaving are extremely good screamers. Like all the shit Sam does in Ready or Not, it's Samara. And then Caitlin too is just like, you're like, hopefully they can scream, because there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
And then it's a tough movie to bring in someone else to scream.
Of course.
And then, yeah, she fucking loves screaming. And it was great.
I saw Tom Woodruff and the ADI crew in the credits for this. It's some pretty heavy hitters. So were they involved, I'm assuming, in the alien design?
Yeah.
So did you get to sit with them and come up with stuff?
It was great.
God, what a trip, man.
Yeah. It was fun because I was like, classic Gray, but what are the bonus features? Kind of thing. And so there's a lot of like, does it have to be gray? Like, when do you lose the design? When does that design become Star Wars?
Yes.
Stuff like that. And then it was just like, how funky can you make it? Like, you know, can they have tattoos and all that kind of stuff? And some of it's not as evident. Like, there is a tattoo element to some of the aliens, but it's not really, it's a darker movie. So, you know, there's not like sleeves or stuff, but there is stuff that is there, but it's not front and center. But even that felt cool to kind of have little backstories for that design and all that fun shit.
Did they get to do maquettes, like actual three-dimensional maquettes?
Someone 3D printed Stefan, our effects guys, 3D printed crude little ones, but not, we didn't have like models.
Right.
Yeah. If Chronicle like wants to hit me up or
whatever. Yeah. All right, man. Well, we've kept you long enough, dude. Leo, you got anything before we set him free?
Yeah. One last thing.
Yeah,
we talked about this is, I mean, you mentioned this, but throughout the movie, you know, something I loved is that whether the alien was present in her house, her neighborhood or not, it always felt omnipresent. Mm-hmm. Like it was always around, you know. And on top of that, it was a spacecraft design, the UFO.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that thing looked menacing. It looked frightening because the certain camera angles.
Yeah.
And how, you know, she's being stalked and from certain altitudes and all that. It felt scary, man. It felt like,
good.
You know, there's people out there, they're like, I want to see a UFO. And I'm like, I don't.
Typically,
that's what it would look like to
exactly.
me.
Exactly.
It's funny. I typically hate drone camera shit. And then there's a ton of it in this. And I got to justify it because I couldn't afford, I couldn't be nope. You know, because that element at least is similar with the ship.
I think it excelled that.
Oh yeah. That, to me, this is everything I hope nope was going to be.
No,
I love
Jean Jacket. I won't allow you guys to slander, but I'll say I couldn't afford that. Or just like those big expansive shots kind of thing. Just also because we were in the woods and that it, you know, we just didn't have that. And so pretty early on, I caved to the drone thing. And then I think it really helped because it is the ship's POV, basically, which felt very funny. And it's, I think it's funny that it's like, it's always like very like calm and just directly smack dab over her. And it's meant to be like, oh yeah, it's the ship, or it's one of the ships, just kind of like, you know, it's like the tracker. Yeah, but that was a fun. And then the UFO too, it was like, I wanted a fucking UFO, because when you see the UFO, you know what the danger is in terms of the light beam in the center, right off the bat. So when Caitlin sees it, she starts freaking out because she's like, oh shit, I'm gonna get sucked up.
Right.
Like, you just have seen enough lore that you know that. But then it was like, okay, well, what else can this thing do that can be just a fun surprise? Like, it doesn't narratively have to like change the movie, but it does. It was like, our goal was like, every time you see something, how does it make Caitlin's life worse? And that was, you know, in terms of what this ship winds up doing. But again, that's another example where the ship comes and the ship's like, oh, fuck it, he fucked up, I'm out. And then like leaves. And, you know, hopefully it doesn't feel frustrating where it's like, you could have just focused and gotten her. But in terms of it being like, we don't know why they leave in that moment, but there's clearly a mistake has been made. And then they're just like, well, we have to go do something else now. And we're going to go do something else now.
Yeah.
As opposed to it feeling like the killer let her get away on purpose kind of thing.
Right. Cat and mouse.
But yeah, that was a ton of fun too.
Well, so moving forward, anything other insane projects down the pike as director?
No, I finished this just coincidentally with our production calendar, like the week before the strike.
Wow.
So then the strike happened and I collapsed. And then the summer has just been a great family summer.
It's good.
With the kids and stuff. Because, you know, making a movie is so hard and all-encompassing, and it feels like it can become adulterous in terms of it being like, you know, I'm gone.
Yeah.
Even when I'm not shooting, I'm gone, you know, 15 hours a day plus. And so it's been really nice to have that time with my wife and kids. And then be able to decompress from the movie. But then also so much of my job gets dependent on how people feel about the movie. And sure. So it's like, you know, if everyone thought it was shit and I did a bad job with the effects, it's like, if my next spec was visual effects related, I'm fucked. I need to go back Duplass style. And so also they're just being like this. It's funny, like this movie, everyone was great about this movie, but like, you know, and I don't know how people are going to feel about the movie, but like so much of the process of it, there's no aliens. So I just didn't even know how the movie felt until like the very end, basically. And that was very stressful. And so there's just been a lot of decompressing of like, I did make a movie with aliens in it. Like for a while, I wasn't sure. So it's been a lot of like good brain turned off time.
Yeah.
I've been playing video games and
you deserve it, man. You got to consume to create, right? It's important. That's great, just man.
Endless lies of pee.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been good. But yeah. And then, you know, soon I need to start discovering. But it's like the first time I took a break in like I probably took like 3 weeks off for like my honeymoon and the birth of my kids and stuff, but like never like this. And it was really needed. So
yeah.
Everyone else is going to show back up with like a ton of work done when the strike is over. And I'm going to be like,
dude, man, you deserve it. You made the quintessential alien invader movie, man. You did amazing. Cool. Amazing. You deserve it. All right. Well, Boo Crew listener, there you go. There's so much to discover with this film. It's total brain candy in all aspects and is profoundly scary. See No One Will Save You on Hulu now and do yourself a favor and take it in on the biggest screen and the best sound system you can find.
Yeah, loud is good.
Extraordinary journey, as all Brian's work is. Mr. Duffield, thank you so much for doing what you do, man.
This was such a treat.
It's awesome, man. Thank you.
And that was the Boo Crew Podcast, episode 401. Thank you for being the most important part of it.
Thanks to our guest Brian Duffield. At time of release, See No One Will Save You exclusively on Hulu. It is unsettling and terrifying and everything you could possibly want it to be. Enjoy it this weekend. Production tracks for this episode provided by Powerman 5000. Till next time, for myself, Lauren, and Leo, it is the Boo Crew saying, sweet scream.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Boo Crew Podcast. Haunt the Boo Crew at TalesFromTheBooCrew.com. Tales from the Boo Crew on Facebook and Instagram. Follow us on Twitter at Tales from the Boo. The Boo Crew is Lauren and Trevor Shand and Leone D'Antonio. The Boo Crew is produced by Lauren Shand, chopped and sliced by Trevor Shand. The Boo Crew is a TSP creation, part of the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
Bye.
A Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network. Home of the Boo Crew. Horror-centric interviews. SCP archives. Weekly full cast storytelling. Horror queers. Genre commentary from an LGBTQ perspective. And creepy. For disturbing and terrifying creepypastas. Listen free wherever you stream audio and at bloodydisgusting.com/podcasts.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.